Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group is hosting a panel discussion on the role of state attorneys general. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinions are those of the speakers. My name is Ted Cruz, and I'll be moderating the discussion. I'm currently a partner at Morgan, Lewis & Bockius, where I lead our U.S. Supreme Court practice and national appellate practice. Previously, I served as the Solicitor General of Texas, and for much of last year was fortunate to enjoy great success as a candidate for Attorney General of Texas, until political changes caused that office not to be vacant in 2010. Our panelists today are as follows. Dr. John Eastman. John is a current candidate for Attorney General of California. A distinguished legal scholar, he's the former dean of Chapman University School of Law and the director of the Center of Constitutional Jurisprudence at the Claremont Institute. He's a former law clerk to Judge J. Michael Luttig and Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. John has a PhD in government from the Claremont Graduate School and his law degree from the University of Chicago Law School. He is also the current chairman of the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. Second, the Honorable James E. Tierney. Jim is the director of the National State Attorneys General Program at Columbia Law School, where he also teaches as a lecturer in law. A national leader of state attorneys general for the last three decades, he served as the Attorney General of Maine from 1980 to 1990. Before becoming Attorney General, he had a distinguished legislative career. At the age of 25, Jim was elected as a Democratic state representative to the Maine legislature, and he became the majority leader at age 29. He is a graduate of the University of Maine and its School of Law. And finally, the Honorable Donald B. Stenberg. Don is of counsel at the Erickson Cedarstorm Law Firm. From 1991 to 2003, he served as the Attorney General of Nebraska and earned a national reputation as a strong conservative leader during that time. In 2000, he was the Republican nominee for senator in Nebraska. Don graduated from the University of Nebraska and received both his JD and his MBA from Harvard University. He is also the current co-chairman of the Federalism Subcommittee for the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group of the Federalist Society. With the introductions out of the way, we turn to our first speaker, Dr. John Eastman.
Thank you, Ted Cruz, for setting that up. We also should point out that you were a former law clerk to Chief Justice Rehnquist at the Supreme Court of the United States, and a number of people around the country watched with keen interest your race for Attorney General down in Texas. As we set up what the role of the Attorney General is, it's obviously a matter that is going to differ from state to state, depending on what the state's constitution's alignment of authority is. In some states, the Attorney General serves more as a member of the cabinet to the governor. In other states, and in fact, most of them, I suspect, the Attorney General has an independent electoral base and an independent judgment in enforcing the law of the state. Some largely supervise the criminal prosecution function of the state. But in most, the function is much broader than that, and it involves the civil and constitutional side as well, defending the state's statutes and initiatives of the people from challenges that they violate either the state or federal constitutions. And it's that role, I think, where the attorney generals of the state are probably most critical in having somebody deeply committed to protecting the rule of law, most essential. Because not all attorney generals have fulfilled that role with focus on the importance of the rule of law. But there's another aspect of the state attorney generals that I want to mention as well before I get into details about that first. And that is, in our federal system of government, we obviously divide authority between governments at both the national and the state levels. And we have mechanisms in order to protect state sovereign interests from encroachment against the federal government. One of those mechanisms are the state delegations that represent their states in Congress. But for many years, since the U.S. senators are no longer elected by the state legislatures, the ability to actually represent the sovereign interests of the state has been watered down a bit. And it seems to me that the role of the state attorney general in defending the state's sovereign interests against what might be encroachments by the federal government as it grows, it seems to be fairly critical. And we see this playing out in a couple of important litigations going on right now. One from Ted's old boss in Texas and the Attorney General of Virginia challenging environmental rulings out of the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, D.C. as based on inadequate or even fraudulent science. And the challenge that those rulings on cap and trade or global warming regulations or carbon dioxide regulations are arbitrary and capricious and overreaching on the authority of the federal government, I think, are an important challenge to keep the federal-state balance in place. Another litigation that we've heard much about in recent weeks and months since the health care bill was passed and signed into law by President Obama are the number of attorney generals around the country that have joined in litigation either out of Virginia or out of Florida challenging the constitutionality of that bill as exceeding Congress's powers under the Commerce Clause or amounting to a direct tax on individual citizens without being apportioned according to population by state as the Constitution requires. And again, these initiatives by the attorney generals are designed to protect the sovereign interests of the state and give them a free hand to make policy judgments for the people within their state against encroachment by the federal government, particularly when those encroachments or those authorities exceed the powers given to the federal government in the Constitution. Now, let me go back to the first point I made briefly, to defend state statutes or initiatives of the people of the state against constitutional challenges. And here I think you find the most interesting academic conundrum for an attorney general. And there are different points of view on how vigorously an attorney general is supposed to defend state statutes. And the same issue comes up with the Office of the Solicitor General in the United States. Some solicitor generals in the United States have taken the position that if there's any colorable argument to be made from history or prior precedent or text or what have you, that an act of Congress is constitutionally valid, it's their obligation to do so. There are others who have taken the position, and I put myself in this camp, that the higher authority of the Constitution has to be protected as well. And as statutes start intruding on that higher authority or start expansively interpreting what the powers of government are, I think it's the role of the Solicitor General at the national level and, quite frankly, attorney generals at the state level as well to remind the courts in any litigation about the constitutionality of those statutes or initiatives what the Constitution itself says about the matter. Now, there's a great gray area on where that line is of vigorous advocacy and defense of the state statute, because the legislature or the people who adopted that initiative are your clients, or the obligation to defend the Constitution that might be infringed by initiatives or state statutes that were not properly solicitous of the authority actually given by the state Constitution. And that's where I'd like to have some of our discussion today, focus on where exactly do you draw that line of vigorous advocacy of a statute that may not be constitutional? When do you throw in the towel and say, we concede that that one probably violates the Constitution, and we have an obligation to defend the Constitution as well? Let me play that out in a couple of specific examples that are playing out in California right now. We have a number of provisions of our state constitution that prohibit the increasing pay retroactively for work that was already done. And 10 years ago, our legislature passed a statute that authorized a retroactive increase, a fairly substantial retroactive increase in the pensions of public employees. It was a 50% increase by a change in the formula that was done. And the estimates are it's costing the state roughly $13 billion a year. So the question I'd like to pose for the audience and then grapple with during the course of our conversation today is, where's the Attorney General's obligation there to defend the statute that appears quite clearly, in my view, to violate those provisions of the state constitution, or to weigh in the court challenges to that statute, saying that the Attorney General is of the position that the Constitution is violated here and that the statute is illegitimate? It's quite a conundrum for attorney generals as they negotiate their day-to-day work, and I'd like to explore a little bit further with our fellow panelists how they would come down on that. Then there's one final issue.
Thank you very sure. much, John. We are next moving on to our second panelist of the day, Jim Tierney. Jim?
Well, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to chat and follow up a little bit on some of John's thoughts. First, just add a little bit of constitutional historical perspective on the Office of Attorney General. In every state but two, state constitutions rejected the federal model wherein the Attorney General is appointed by the executive. Now, of course, we all know Eric Holder is our Attorney General. He's appointed by the president. But in the states, that's not how it works. 43 are elected statewide in partisan elections. Another 5 are selected through other mechanisms that are nonetheless partisan. So for reasons which oftentimes make people wonder, state governments say, well, this is different. Now, where did that come from? If you study the underlying jurisprudence and the history and how this office arose from our colonial experience, our colonial past, you'll find that there was a deep, deep concern among the individuals who wrote our state constitutions about too much executive power. They liked the idea of having the attorney general not simply be the handmaiden for a particular agency or even a particular governor who's also elected statewide. So they actually set up a system which would inevitably result in friction, not because of the personality of the office holders, but because that's the way they wanted it. They wanted it to be the kind of friction where the attorney general stands for the rule of law and the Constitution on the one hand, and fully acknowledging that a governor and the state legislature will have particular agendas and particular policies they want to count out. So it's a very interesting intellectual concept, the idea of the divided executive, which sets state attorneys general off from anyone else, from district attorneys, city attorneys, and certainly our own federal judiciary. So with that background, we find all 50 states have attorneys general. We have about 12,000 men and women who work in AG offices around the country. The vast majority of them are spending their time giving day-to-day legal advice to state agencies and representing those agencies in court when they get sued. And I think John's question is, well, how do they represent them? You know, what kind of deference does an assistant attorney general or an attorney general give to all their boards and commissions out there? Do they treat them the way you treat a private client, in which you give great deference if you are a private attorney to your client agency, and you say, well, you're the boss, you just tell us what to say, we'll go in and do it? I don't think anybody's very comfortable with that. Government lawyering is different. Your government lawyers are supposed to provide independent judgment, even if they're not independently selected. So, but how about the other extreme? Does this mean the fact that the attorney general is elected and separate from the executive pretty much means that the AG can stand up and say, well, I don't think this is constitutional, or I don't like this law, or, you know, this provision went too far? Well, I think most of us feel a little uncomfortable with that, too. That sets an attorney general up as kind of in the words of one judge in a dissenting case, said the attorney general is not an unfeathered monarch. And so how does this work? Well, on a day-to-day basis, these thousands of assistant AGs and the men and women who are have held this position, as Don Stenberg and I both have had the honor of doing, kind of work these out. You work hard not to create a conflict. You attempt to counsel your agencies and counsel the legislatures in such a way as to avoid a constitutional crisis. People don't like to see their governors and their attorneys general disagreeing. They expect government to work. They don't like to see, you know, dueling press conferences and lightning bolts thrown back and forth. And so the first obligation, I think, for the attorney general and his or her staff is to provide that kind of daily, constant, careful, highly credible legal advice. Well, if the client thinks that the AG is going to jump ship every time the client agency disagrees, well, there's not going to be a lot of truth-telling back and forth between the two. So there's a lot of human judgment involved here before you get to kind of the ultimate principled question, which I think John is starting with, which is, you know, what do you really do if you're the attorney general and you think something's unconstitutional? I mean, how do you do this? How do you handle this? Well, if you go onto our website at stateag.org, you'll see that I led a discussion on this precise issue with the incumbent and former attorneys general of both political parties. And the first thing you'll notice is, you often notice when AGs get together, there's absolutely no partisan breakdown. People really wrestle with this issue. How much deference do you give? How far do you go on something that you think is unconstitutional? It is a very tough call, and frankly, it's going to have to be decided based on two things. First of all, the facts and the constitution of the case, just how clear is it? How settled is the law? Because if you're the Attorney General, you don't want to say, well, I think it's unconstitutional, but, you know, the circuits are really split here. I mean, if the circuits are split, you're going to defend that state law. That's your job. You're not there to just kind of put your own personal view on top of this. And then secondly, what is your internal case state law as to the discretion that an Attorney General can have in this situation? Maine, Massachusetts, Nebraska, Illinois, the AGs have a great deal of discretion. California, Arizona, Iowa, not so much. Connecticut, not so much. The attorneys general are really expected to take a strong guide from the governor and their agency. So the attorney general has to balance those two issues before they reach that really tough decision. But it's, you put your finger on a tough issue, John, and it's great to talk about it.
Thank you very much, Jim. We'll now turn to our third panelist, Don Stenberg.
Well, I would begin by reiterating what the other two panelists have said, and that first and foremost, you need to look at your state constitution, what your highest court in your state has said about the authority of the attorney general and what discretionary authority he has, as well as your state statutes that bear on that issue. I thought maybe I would address a couple of these issues based on what my thoughts were when I was the attorney general, recognizing that not every state's going to be in the same situation legally as Nebraska, and probably not every AG is going to agree with my thoughts. But on a couple of the issues that John mentioned, the defense of state statutes, if they're unconstitutional. My view on that was that if a state statute was clearly unconstitutional, not only did we not defend it, we would affirmatively file a lawsuit to have it declared unconstitutional. And my reasoning on that was that the Constitution, whether it's the state or federal constitution, is the highest law. The Attorney General is sworn to uphold the law, and so if a statute is clearly unconstitutional, my view was that that part of my role was to uphold the Constitution by having that statute declared unconstitutional. In my 12 years as Attorney General, I believe we did that four or five times. In each case, we received unanimous decisions from our state Supreme Court declaring those statutes unconstitutional, which I felt upheld our judgment that those statutes clearly were unconstitutional. To put a little concreteness to it, for example, one of the statutes passed by the legislature that I did challenge successfully in our state Supreme Court basically made it a criminal offense for someone to circulate and initiate a referendum petition outside of the county of their residence. And so if you were a resident of Douglas County, Omaha, Nebraska, and you went down to the capital city of Lincoln to circulate a petition, an initiative petition, you were in violation of the criminal laws of the state. We felt that was clearly unconstitutional for reasons we don't need to go into that I think are obvious, and we had that thrown out. Generally, my view, though, was if a statute could be reasonably defended, we felt that we had the obligation to do that. I do agree that it's a proper role for the state attorney general in an appropriate case to challenge federal action against the state in defense of state sovereignty. We did that on a few occasions during my 12 years, not with a lot of success. But to give one example, in the closing days of the Clinton administration, they changed some of the safe drinking water measurements so that they set much higher standards for drinking water than had been in place for decades. This imposed tremendous financial obligations on small communities in Nebraska where arsenic is a naturally occurring substance in groundwater. So we did challenge that on the basis that there was no interstate commerce and the 10th Amendment. Unfortunately, there were some procedural matters that caused us some problems. But I do think it's an appropriate role for a state attorney general to defend state sovereignty. It is a federal government. Most of the police authority is supposed to be in the states, and the federal government is supposed to be limited to enumerated powers. And so the defense of the state sovereignty, I think, is a very appropriate role for the state attorney general. Certainly, and Jim Tierney mentioned this a little bit, is the conflicts with the governor, and I had some of those as attorney general. They tend to be high profile. I think
you want to avoid them if you can. I think a lot of people who've actually been state attorney general, though, at some point you have a governor who, having been elected governor, thinks they're in charge of the entire executive branch. They don't really entirely accept the premise that a state attorney general has been independently elected and has an independent constitutional role to play. And so sometimes conflicts do occur, and the governor often looks at the attorney general as his personal lawyer who should do what he's told. And as Jim Turney very correctly pointed out, the attorney general in the area of the state's litigation, at least in many states, has the constitutional duty to determine the proper litigation posture for the state, and that's pretty hard for a lot of governors to accept. So those create some interesting issues, and a smart attorney general will, as much as possible, avoid those conflicts, but sometimes they are unavoidable.
Thank you very much, Don. We will now move to each of the panelists having 2 minutes to respond to the comments made by the prior panelist. We'll start again with Dr. John Eastman.
I want to pick up on the point that Don Stenberg closed with, because I think it's a very interesting conundrum, and it's particularly acute in California. And I'm thinking of an example almost 30 years ago. George Duke Majan, who would later become governor of the state when he was serving as attorney general, took a fairly aggressive stand on the independence of the attorney general. But among his duties was to advise other constitutional officers of the state, including the governor, about the constitutionality of their actions. And the courts upheld his independent judgment in almost every instance. But the one area where they did not, and he was serving as attorney general under Jerry Brown, who was governor in the 1970s, is now a candidate for governor again. One area where the California court did not uphold his independence was having given advice to the governor. When the governor rejected the advice, General turned around to sue him for violating the Constitution. And the court held that violated his ethical obligations as an attorney suing his former client. And so the normal conundrums one has in dealing with a governor is exacerbated when the governor is treated as client for one moment and the Constitution is client the other moment, and create quite a conundrum on how you negotiate that jail, that passageway. Do you just not give advice to the governor from get-go when you think he's going to act unconstitutionally, or do you try and insist that apply with your advice when you don't have any authority to make him do that?
Well, this is Jim Turney again. California case is kind of on the extreme, and frankly, there's never been an attorney general since that time, John, who believes that case is still good law, and they're anxious to relitigate it, and every time they try, the governor's back down. It was an extreme case and an aberration, I think, even under the California Constitution. But the real way to handle these questions is, I think, as Don has pointed out, is you try to get ahead of them. You try to use your counseling function as the attorney general. Say, look, you may have some constitutional issues here. This is a serious issue. And you try to develop it in advance, and if you have to challenge it. In terms of challenging the federal government, we've got some great ironies going on now. I certainly believe an attorney general has the right, if not the obligation, to challenge a federal statute that they think is imposing unconstitutional burdens on their citizenry. But one of the great ironies we're seeing now is in the and this is why you never say never in the AG world. You have a number of states who are challenging the constitutionality of the health reform law, and they're using, in order to get into court, a principle called standing, which allows them to get in, which is enunciated in a case that was brought from the other extreme of some attorneys general who challenged the Bush administration a few years ago and went up to the Supreme Court at EPA versus Massachusetts. So you really have a federalism question here. You have a separation of powers question. You really don't have a partisan issue. And decisions that decide one way bounce around in this business, and they have one impact in one state and one in another.
Well, this is Don Stenberg. I'll pick up on one thing that was mentioned earlier, and that's about your clients, the boards, your boards, commissions, state agencies. And I think both the other panelists commented briefly. In Nebraska, we have a real clear-cut Nebraska Supreme Court decision going back many decades that very clearly says that the state attorney general controls the state's litigation, whether the state agency agrees with the disposition of a particular case or not. A lot of lawyers who do not work in the attorney general's office don't really understand that concept, because, of course, in private practice, the critical decisions are always up to the client to whether to file a lawsuit, whether to settle the lawsuit, the terms that you're going to settle it on. In private practice, the lawyer has an ethical duty to do what basically is directed by the client on those critical decisions. At least in Nebraska, and I know a number of other states, the attorney general is in a very different situation. Not only are you the lawyer, you are the legal decision maker for the state and for all the state agencies. And it's a concept that's very important, I think, to the state. It's certainly something that most any attorney general likes to have that authority. But sometimes it takes a lot of explaining to the lawyers and the agencies that's the way the system is supposed to work.
Thank you, gentlemen. And we've had so far, I think, a robust discussion on the differing responsibilities of an attorney general and a governor of state. I suspect if we had three governors on the phone, we might have slightly different perspectives. We'll now move to the question portion of this podcast. And I want to begin with something that a number of you referenced, which is the current attorney general lawsuits that have been filed, number one, challenging the president's health care plan, and number two, challenging the EPA's efforts to address global warming. And on each of those, I want to ask all three of you three direct questions. Number one, should those lawsuits have been brought? Number two, are they likely to prevail? And number three, should they prevail?
Let me take that up first. This is John Eastman. Yes, I think they should be brought. This is a massive alteration of a fairly significant sector of the economy. We have traditionally treated health care issues as part of the state's reserved powers under the 10th Amendment. The power to regulate the health, safety, welfare, and morals is how we define the police power. Health is the first item in that list. We have federal policy, longstanding federal law that even prohibits interstate competition among insurance carriers. We have traditionally, historically, and I think constitutionally left these matters to the states. The transformation that's occurred here clearly alters the federal-state balance. It seems therefore appropriate for attorneys general whose interest is to represent the state's sovereign interest in this federal system. It seems clearly appropriate for them to have brought the litigation challenging it. Are they likely to succeed? I think that's a very, very close call. On the one hand, the way we have developed the Commerce Clause jurisprudence in this country, it's not just commerce among the states, interstate commerce that we can regulate, but anything that has a substantial effect on interstate commerce, at least any economic activity that has a substantial effect. Now, there are some justices, my former boss, Justice Thomas, that think that substantial effect test is much too broad, but the majority of the court seems comfortable with a substantial effects test. And it's a little hard to say that regulations that affect one-sixth of the national economy don't have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. Now, there's a bit of a bootstrap argument about that it's the regulations themselves that are causing the effect on the economy to give rise to the authority to issue the regulations. But I think that's a bit too nuanced, and I don't think the courts will strike it down on those grounds. They may strike it down when it's side by side with federal law that says we don't have interstate commerce at all in insurance contracts in the healthcare field, and maybe that will be enough. There's another aspect of the cases, though, that seems much more objective rather than this subjective balancing of the impact on the national economy and what have you. And that is the direct tax must be apportioned argument that's raised in the Florida litigation. And the argument there runs that because this is a tax or a fine imposed by people who just refuse to buy the health care mandate, that it's a direct tax. It's not tied to their income, although there is a cap on it according to income. But it's not an income tax. And that as a result, it's a direct tax. And under Article 1 of the Constitution, direct taxes are supposed to be apportioned according to population, and it is not. And that's a very interesting challenge. Whether it's likely to succeed or not, I don't know. Should it succeed, or the Commerce Clause argument succeed? Absolutely. I think this is an overreach by the federal government, certainly well beyond the more limited role of federal power that was envisioned by our Constitution and its founders.
Don, you want to go?
Well, yeah, I'll take a crack at that. The health care bill specifically, and I would focus on the requirement that an individual purchase health insurance. I'm not a Commerce Clause expert, but to me, this is a step that's never been taken before. In other words, a federal law that compels a citizen to buy a product. And it seems to me that if the federal government can compel you to buy health insurance, they could compel you to buy a car from the car company they own, or they could compel you to do business at a certain place, or to buy certain foods or whatever. Now, that's not to say that Congress would enact that, but the legal principle would be the same. And it seems to me when the Congress seeks to compel someone to purchase something they don't want to purchase, they're not regulating interstate commerce. There would be no commerce but for the requirement in the look at that in an individual case. And so my sense is on that issue, at least, that there is a good chance to prevail if you look at some of the school zone cases, the gun cases that have come out of the U.S. Supreme Court in the last 15 years or so, that there's at least a good argument there, and I would hope that they would prevail. I'm not as familiar, frankly, with all the legal arguments being made in the environmental case. I do think that there's a substantial question on whether the science supports regulation of carbon dioxide, and that certainly is something I believe should be litigated somewhere. And if the states are willing to take it on and can establish standing, I'm glad to see them do it.
Well, I certainly believe an attorney general has the right to bring this case. I want to make that clear, because there's been a lot of mumbling and grumbling on the left that they don't think. I do think an attorney general has that power. And of course, from a constitutional perspective, it doesn't mean it doesn't really make any difference whether one attorney general brings it or 50. So, you know, the constitutional argument is going to rise or fall. And there's also been a lot of hemming and hawing. How many attorneys general have sued or not sued? That's all goes to the kind of the political weight of the issue. I'm not a common law expert, but should it have been filed? Look, somebody's going to file it. I mean, we live in a world you can't do anything without getting sued by somebody. But what about the public policy? I don't know. I'm not a common law expert. From what I can see, I don't have any trouble with somebody making me buy insurance. I don't care. State government makes me buy car insurance. Federal government wants me to buy health insurance, if that's part of the national scheme to reduce this health crisis we have, both in terms of costs and accessibility, with millions of people walking around without any insurance at all, if that's the mechanism to do it, and that's what Congress says, I mean, I think it's within their power. Who's going to win? Absolutely guaranteed, 100%, nobody knows. And the idea that either John or Don or me can say, hey, we don't even know who's going to be on the court when this thing finally winds its way up there. We don't know how the health law is going to proceed. We don't know how future Congresses are going to amend it and change it. A lot of people want to repeal it altogether. I don't know. I just gave up guessing where future judges who may get on the court and may get confirmed are going to vote on close issues. You know, I just don't do that. I used to when I was a kid, but I outgrew it. I leave that to law professors who kind of try to decide how many angels dance on the head of the pin. I think the far more interesting question, the public policy questions that arise out of the healthcare debate and the Constitution will be decided sometime in, 2014, 2015.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. Let's move on to the second question, which is a broad question of should an attorney general be an activist? And I want to bring that to a more narrow and specific example. The first question we just discussed of the Obamacare lawsuits and the EPA lawsuits, many on the right tend to be fans of those lawsuits, many on the left tend to be critical of those lawsuits. I want to turn to a second example where those sides are reversed. And I want to talk about former Attorney General out of New York, Eliot Spitzer, who after he was governor had certain issues, but before that time, as Attorney General, he was notorious. And he was also respected. He was by far the best-known state attorney general in the country and brought a series of aggressive lawsuits against businesses. And my question to all three members of the panel is an attorney general like Eliot Spitzer using the job to vigorously go after business, is that good or bad?
Well, it's a silly question, Ted, as you know. So let me challenge the underlying principle. Saying should an attorney general like Eliot Spitzer, that's like saying you know, should the president like Teddy Roosevelt, or should the president like Abraham Lincoln, people we've never had before and we haven't seen since, define the standard of the presidency? I mean, that's just not the way the real world works and hasn't worked. We did see during the Spitzer term a complete meltdown on the federal regulatory side. It was embarrassing. It was a shame. We saw the SEC implode. We saw people resign in disgrace. We saw in the Department of Interior people go to prison. I think some of them are still there. You know, with scandals, we saw federal government's refusal to provide the basic kind of environmental protection that would stop this horrendous oil spill, which is going to cost our country billions of dollars, not to mention the environmental thing. And so we see an attorney general sometimes when they're totally frustrated, when the federal government just refuses to do its job. They get frustrated and they jump in. Now, should they jump in? That's going to be fact-specific. That's going to be AG-specific, and that's going to be a complicated question. Step back to 30,000 feet, though. The great question you ask, the non-silly question, is should an attorney general be an activist? And the answer is, of course. The entire culture around offices of attorneys general is one of activism, because so often when you sit there and you're the only one sitting there, it's not like when you're in the legislature or the Congress and other people are there to kind of help you along. You have to make the decision. You know, was that trial fair? Are we going to proceed with the execution tonight? That's an activist decision, or not. Are we going to, you know, countenance a certain level of illegality in a certain area? That's an activist decision. Or should I sit back and wait for someone else to do it? The whole culture around AG offices are activism, and I think that stems from the fact that it is separate from the executive branch within each state government. Sometimes the activism is liberal, sometimes it's conservative. I think that probably the Obama administration would say the attorneys general who sued on health care to strike down health reform were being activist attorneys general. So to ask the abstract question about activism, I think, is to answer it. AGs are active. They always have been active. They should be active. How they're active, what they do in a democracy will oftentimes reflect on, you know, what's going on in the world at the time and the sort of level of support that an individual receives, not just from the electorate, but from other stakeholders, from the courts, from the judiciary, from members of the legislature, from their governor. All those things help define how far an attorney general can move and when they move.
Yeah, I've got a bit of a different view on that. We've got an issue percolating up right now as a result of the subprime mortgage crisis. Should attorney generals be aggressively going after the mortgage lenders, crafting new claims of fraud that really were not fraud at all, but just simply failure to predict a downtick in the market? I have no problem with attorney generals being aggressive and active going against actual fraud, but trying to change the rules after the fact and bring pressure to bear to force renegotiation of contracts. And
do you have some examples there where attorneys general are bringing down some innocent banks here in the subprime issue?
Well, we've got lots of calls for it. I don't have attorney generals doing it, and I think they're okay. Withstanding the calls for it are the appropriate thing.
You mean calls on the telephone, or I'm...
No. Calls from citizen groups, activist groups that want their attorney generals to be more aggressive in prosecuting alleged frauds. When what we've really got is just people that made loans to houses that then went down in value, and try and make new law and make new claims.
Well, I'd love to see some examples of that, because, you know, John, that everything what you see, if you're out there in the street, you're watching the millions of people who've lost their homes, you see people who've perpetrated fraud, changed contracts, sold contracts to people in one language when they couldn't speak it, had highly incentivized salespeople in the field, in which all AGs, really Republicans and Democrats, joined together to do something about it. So I think I'd be careful before I say we've got calls from, without identifying who are the calls and what are the issues that you're talking about. You're kind of floating around out there, I think.
No, I know, but the demands are that this be more aggressive prosecution, and I began. If there's actual fraud that went on, that's appropriate role. But when you're talking about the attorney general becoming an activist, that means kind of pushing the limits on the law. It's kind of like what happened with the pressure that was brought to bear on General Motors bondholders to forego their secured prior position on on funds that were available to give it to unsecured creditors, and by different threats behind the scenes to kind of force them to relinquish those claims. That's where I think an activist attorney general crosses the line.
Well, wait a minute, John. You just said earlier on the health reform bill that it was a very close call as to whether that compact clause would come out that way. Very close call. So if you were on the other side of your issue substantively, and you saw a bunch of AGs suing on something that's a very close call, very tough case, you would have to say, well, they're being activists. So the word is not activist. The fact is that you don't like the AGs kind of getting into the over-regulation business of lending. I get that part. I get that part. But I don't get the part of saying the Attorney General is an activist as if it's some kind of dirty word. I know it's kind of the buzzword these days, but it doesn't really make much sense. It depends on what you're being active about.
Don Stenberg, maybe I can jump in here and add my two cents. I think it depends on what you mean by activist. I mean, on the one hand, an attorney general must necessarily initiate actions, you know, prosecute a criminal case, file an environmental lawsuit if there's been a spill of a dangerous chemical. So in that sense, every attorney general must take the initiative and could be described as an activist because you're initiating lawsuits to enforce the law. I think what the term activist may be used sometimes, and maybe is what is intended at least by John, is when an attorney general files lawsuits that appear not to be justified by the law or by the facts of the case.
No AG should ever do that under any
circumstances. Well, I agree. We should never do that. And the thing is that in the final analysis, it's going to come down to the judgment of the attorney general. It's a very powerful position, and a former Nebraska attorney general going back some years when I was an aide to the governor told me, he said, you know, before I file any case, particularly any criminal action, he said, I take into account that I am ruining someone's career potentially, no matter what the final decision might be in the courthouse. So I'm very careful before I file these actions to make sure that, in my judgment at least, we're going to be successful and we have the law and the facts to support it. In the final analysis, it comes down to the judgment of the attorney general, or if it doesn't go that high, one of the assistant attorney generals, as to whether the law and the facts justifies a certain legal proceeding. And I don't think there's any dispute that some attorneys general from time to time make a misjudgment on that.
I think we're having a fabulous exchange right now. Let me ask a follow-up question to bring out perhaps some further differing opinions, which is another example that some have pointed to of activism among the AGs is the tobacco lawsuits that were brought by a great many attorneys general across the country. Two questions regarding the tobacco lawsuits. Number one, were they a good thing or a bad thing? And number two, in particular, was the aspect that in a number of states, the attorneys general hired plaintiffs' lawyers on a contingency fee basis. And as a result, a great many tobacco lawyers became multimillionaires, earning hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars in legal fees as a result of bringing cases on behalf of the state and using, to some extent, the state's sovereign authority in that lawsuit. And so my question is, were the tobacco lawsuits good or bad, and is it a good or bad thing to hire lawyers on a contingency fee basis to litigate on behalf of the attorney general?
Yeah, let me take up the second question first. I generally think it's a bad idea to allow contingency fees for class actions because it really skews the incentives beyond what they ought to be. But it's particularly troubling when the contingency is on a state-run case for the reasons you identified, Ted. And the potential for corruption down the road with some of those contingency fees being kicked back in to campaign coffers of the very people that gave out the bids, the kind of accusations that swirl around that, even if at the end of the day they turn out not to be true, really raise eyebrows about the legitimacy of our political system and its potential to be bought out. But there's no question that oftentimes attorney general's offices need to retain outside counsel, either for expertise or just sheer manpower. But there's absolutely nothing that ought to prevent them from doing it on an hourly basis. The reason the contingency fee arrangement was, kind of rose up in private sector litigation is because you were taking a risk of, on behalf of a client who couldn't pay you, that if you did not prevail, there wouldn't be a fee at all. And so there's a contingency fee, and it tends to be larger to account for the risk. Well, if the state has retained you, there's no risk that you're not going to be paid. And so an hourly rate ought to suffice to gather whatever kind of expertise and manpower the state needs to bring legitimate actions. And the notion that these things were run on contingency and private actors using the power of the state made hundreds of millions of dollars or more is really troubling.
So you would have opposed filing the tobacco lawsuits, John?
What's that?
You would have opposed filing the tobacco lawsuits?
No, I would have proposed hiring them out to contingency fee lawyers.
You mean non-contingency fee lawyers, I think.
No, if I was going to hire them out, I would have hired them out on an hourly rate rather than giving them a contingency and a share of the funds.
If your legislature refused to appropriate the funds to do that, would you have filed a lawsuit at all? Or would
I don't think I would have filed that lawsuit at all. But recognize that some of the claims had some merit that some attorney generals might want to. But if the legislature refused to appropriate the funds to hire outside counsel, then I would have, and I thought the lawsuit should have been filed, I would have filed it with the staff in the office itself. The notion that we're going to give millions and millions of dollars on a contingent to outside counsel is troubling. It's the state money and the risk of not getting paid that normally exists in private contingency fee litigation doesn't exist when the state is your client.
Well, of course, that's just wrong. A number of states' AGs have hired a contingency fee counsel who came up with defense verdicts, and they got zero. So, as a matter of fact, it's wrong. But let's go back to Ted's, I think, rather interesting question on tobacco. The case was filed 14 years ago. They were settled actually longer than that. Now, they were filed 16 years ago, and they were filed and they were settled 12 years ago. So we're digging back in time. But people love to go back to it to try to reconstruct the world as it looked in the 1990s. I think there's no question that the filing of the tobacco case was another indication of a complete failure of the federal government to address a huge, huge public health problems. There's no question that tobacco should have been handled by regulation and by taxation. Absolutely no question. There's no place for the tort system or a quasi-tort system to come into play. But the problem was that the federal government hadn't done that. And, matter of fact, they only got around to giving the Food and Drug Administration jurisdiction over tobacco just last year after they had to overcome the veto by President Bush, or the threatened veto by President Bush. So the lawsuits were a last resort. I mean, I worked on them. I didn't like them. I didn't like the legal theory. I think they wouldn't help. But on the other hand, you had spiraling. You had the tobacco industry lying. You had the tobacco industry selling cigarettes to kids. You had a whole series of huge public health problems. The rates, especially among young kids, were spiraling. In 94, 95, rates were going up in every state in the country. So the lawsuits then became sort of a last resort deal. I mean, it shouldn't have happened. The federal government should have done its job. And I wish they had. And if they had, the whole lawsuits wouldn't have happened. The whole contingency debate wouldn't have happened. And, that would have been the end of the story.
Let me go back to the point you said I was wrong. When they do a contingency case and there's a defense verdict, they don't get paid. That's not my point, Jim. The state has the resources to hire outside counsel. They don't need to hire people on contingency in order to get somebody to represent them, like an indigent client who's bringing a civil rights claim or something else needs to.
If you're sitting down there right now in Louisiana and in Mississippi and all the Gulf Coast region of Florida, you're watching that oil come trickling in and you're trying to figure out whether you're going to be able to take on BP or not with the assistant AGs you have on staff, that's a tough call. I'm not going to say whether an attorney general should or should not under those circumstances. Like as Don said, you have to use your, these are tough calls. They're not theoretical law school questions where you can say, well, I would never do this and I would never do that. You're sitting there, the oil's coming into shore, you've got a problem, BP is sitting out there, and right now the AGs of the coastal region have had several meetings and they're trying to figure out what to do. Now, you may feel comfortable to say under no circumstances should any of those attorney general ever hire a contingency counsel. I have no idea. That's why they have the job and not me. It's a tough call.
Well, let me propose this, that if we're going to hire contingency fee counsel, we give them triple the value of the hours actually done, rather than making them rich on a windfall if they do hit it big with their litigation.
Well, I'm with you there. I would certainly hope the AGs would negotiate as tough a deal as they could with those contingent counsels if they have to do it. I hope they don't have to do it all. I think contingency counsel is wrong if you can avoid it in any way possible. I think the best public law is done by full-time public lawyers. Have no question about that. There's all kinds of issues, bad issues, that are potentially there with a contingency fee counsel. So it's really up to the Attorney General to negotiate a very tough, very tight contract, not just on fees, but on control of the litigation, in some ways even worse than the fees, John, if you get into it. I hope you don't ever have to. You'll find that the real issue becomes that the lawyers will want to run away with the case and take it away from the Attorney General, and the Attorney General loses control. There's a very interesting Supreme Court case out of Rhode Island, which talks about that precise issue, about how if the state is going to use contingency fee counsel, then it must be public lawyers. It has to be driven by public lawyers, and every key decision has to be made by it. And I think that's completely correct.
Don, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I'll jump in a little bit. I might note that I wrote a little piece on this for the Washington Legal Foundation back in 2003 about why, in my judgment, states shouldn't hire contingent fee lawyers to represent them. So I can't cover all of that. But number one, I agree with John that the state is not a pauper. Contingent fees originated kind of as an exception to the rule of the lawyer's not supposed to have an interest in the case in order to.
Did you ever do it, Don? Did you ever do it?
No, we never did.
I did it maybe once or twice in 10 years.
We never did.
Very rare.
But the other thing is, and I know, and this isn't necessarily the law in every state, and it's only been litigated, I think, in a few. But to me, it invades on the legislature's authority to appropriate the funds, which is a very important public policy tool. And to take the example you just mentioned, which is an important one, in Louisiana and the oil spill, it seems to me, in my judgment at least, the appropriate way for the Attorney General to handle that would be to go to the legislature and say, listen, this is costing us billions. We have a good lawsuit here against BP and probably several other potential defendants. I need an appropriation of X dollars so that I can pursue this. And I think, in that case, the Attorney General very likely would get it. And my position on that, Jim, is if the legislature can't convince the legislature it's important enough to appropriate money to pursue, then that's an appropriate public policy decision the legislature has made. Now, if the Attorney General can pursue it with the resources he already has or she already has, you know, go to it. That's kind of my view on it.
Okay, very good. We will now move to our final closing statements, and each of the three panelists will have 2 minutes to give a closing statement. And one question I will ask each of the three panelists to think about and to include in their closing statements is, what should be the top three priorities of an Attorney General and why? And for the final closing statements, let's invert the order, and so start with Don Stenberg and then move on to Jim Tierney and close with John Eastman. Don?
Well, I haven't had much time to think about that, so I'll take a crack at it. I think first and foremost, you're there to enforce the laws of the state, whether it's your criminal laws, if you have that jurisdiction, the consumer protection laws, environmental laws within your authority. So number one, enforce the laws of the state fairly and based on the law and the facts. Probably number two, in terms of day-to-day, is to defend lawsuits filed against the state, its officers and employees, someone injured on state property, some employee who's been fired, who sues. It's not glamorous, but it's part of the major function of the state attorney general. I guess to me the third one would be to make sure the Constitution is upheld. If that requires challenging unconstitutional state statutes, do it. If it requires suing the federal government for encroaching on state sovereignty, do it. I think that's an important role for the Attorney General. It's a small part of the job in terms of the hours and the lawyers devoted to it. On the other hand, it's very high profile and very important in terms of the sovereignty of the state, proper application of the state and federal constitutions.
I'm sorry, I'm coughing here a little bit. Don's answers were great. The first thing I'd want to say, working in an AG's office, fabulous opportunity. If there are any lawyers out there, young or old, who want to really get involved in high quality practice, I certainly hope they try to get a job in an AG's office. It's great. It's nonpartisan. It's fun. It's interesting. It's satisfying beyond imagination. And the top responsibility of the AGs is just do their job and to do it well every day. Come in and suit up and get out there. So much of these discussions get hung up on contingency fees and a very, very small percentage of cases. You go back 10 years, you go back 15 years to talk about this AG or that AG, which is kind of, you know, in the popular vogue. But to really walk into an AG's office today, as I do all the time, and meet with attorneys general of both political parties all the time is always a thrill for me. They're fabulous men and women. They work very hard. And the work they do is very, very satisfying. And it is the least partisan place left in American politics. And I hope some of that survives as years go by.
And I want to reiterate that comment. I think that's an extremely important part of the AG's, the manner in which the AG fulfills all of the three roles that Don Stenberg outlined. And I agree with those three roles and even the prioritization of them. The AG also is in many states the top cop, the supervising district attorney of the state, if you will. And there's going to be some prioritization that gets set out of that office on criminal enforcement, what have you. And I think that's an important thing. But critically important in the way in which the AG's office goes about performing that role is they're not like other private attorneys, where they have a client and the advocacy for the client is aggressive to the point of spinning in many instances. The relationship the courts have developed with the attorney generals across the country, as with the Solicitor General's Office or the Department of Justice at the United States, is one that recognizes that the role of the government attorney, the attorney general, the district attorney, the solicitor general, the Department of Justice lawyer, is really to adhere to the higher notions of justice that we expect. And there's a deference that the courts give to those offices because of that traditional manner in which they perform that role. And so the level of professionalism, honesty in the briefing, advocacy, yes, but honest advocacy before the courts that has earned that deference is something that has to be protected in the role of the Attorney General, it seems to me.
Well, thank you very much. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all three of our panelists. We were fortunate to have three national experts and a robust debate on the role of the Attorney General, an important issue and one that will continue to have profound effects on our nation going forward. I want to thank everyone for listening to this podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. For related materials to the podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you very much for listening.